Everybody, you have been listening to a first on the Invisible College. That was the first instance of what will be, I think, many as we go through time, of hearing the voice of one of our subjects. That was the voice of Alfred Lord Tennyson, recorded on a wax cylinder by an agent of the Edison Recording Company in 1890, shortly before Tennyson's death, in an early moment of recording technology. And that is Tennyson reciting one of his most famous poems, The Charge of the Light Brigade, which I will mention at some point later, maybe, if I think of it. It's not a poem that interests me very much, but it has a role in the life of Alfred Lord Tennyson. So that was the voice of Alfred Lord Tennyson. And this is a lecture on Alfred Lord Tennyson entitled A Deeper Voice Across the Storm, which is a line from his greatest, perhaps, poem In Memoriam. And I will explain the meaning of that lecture in a moment, the meaning of the title of the lecture in a moment. Before I do, let me reintroduce myself. This is John Pistelli, the host of The Invisible College, my series of literature courses for paid subscribers to my Substack, grandhotelabyss.substack.com. That is where you can go to find the slideshow corresponding to this lecture. It is where you can go to find my free to all weekly newsletter on literature and culture. It is where you can go to find the archive of my now completed serial of my novel, Major Arcana. It is where you can go to find other occasional pieces. It is where you can go if you're listening to this for free. It is where you can go to offer a paid subscription, or even a free subscription if you don't even know how you landed on this page, but somehow you did, and you're listening to the free part of the recording. Please do subscribe to my Substack to keep up with what we're talking about in terms of literature and culture from the contemporary period. My weekly newsletter often addresses the most contemporary developments in culture. For instance, I wrote a little review of Dune Part 2, the film by Denis Villeneuve from Frank Herbert's novel, which came out in the week I'm recording this, but also to keep up with the history of culture and of literature, which we discuss here at the Invisible College. So that's what we're doing here. I am again your host, John Pistelli. Today, we move to the Victorian era. And I wanted to start with the recording of Tennyson in 1890, which is still the Victorian era. The Victorian era goes from, technically, from the accession of Queen Victoria to the throne when she's 18 years old in 1837 to her death in 1901 I think that's, I'll kick myself if I'm wrong, but I think it's 1901. So it extends for the better part of the 19th century. In cultural and literary terms, you sometimes would begin it even before that. Yeah, 1901. Sorry, just checking. With in the 1830s, the earlier 1830s. Sometimes it's dated from 1832, which is the a political event, which is not the accession of the Queen, which takes place 5 years later, but the passage of a reform bill in the British Parliament, which we talked in during the our discussion of the Romantic period about all of the unrest in English life. That was a consequence of that 30, 40-year period coming out of the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars. And the reform bill, the first reform bill, there would be subsequent ones later in the 19th century, was one of the first acts that the government kind of undertakes to stem some of this unrest. It reforms, it's largely an electoral reform act, and it eliminates some of the inequalities of the electoral system, brings some of them up to date with England's changing population and demographics as it goes from a solely agricultural economy to an economy that would be mixed between industry and agriculture. And it expands the franchise largely to include the middle class. So it eases, there had been a property requirement to vote. So, first of all, only males could vote, and then only males who held a certain amount of property. They eased that property requirement to the point where essentially the middle classes could now vote. And then in subsequent reform bills later in the Victorian period, I think there's one in 1867, one in 1884. They expand the franchise further. By the end of the 19th century, all working class men can vote more or less. And then about 100 years after the first reform bill, you get universal suffrage with universal female suffrage in 1928. And so there's a series of reforms that are attempting to ease some of these pressures on England. Because remember, one of the things about England is that after the 17th century, they don't have a revolution the way they do have revolutions in France or in Russia. And so that's often why it's a target for the kind of radical critics we were talking about last week. Critics like Terry Eagleton or Nancy Armstrong or Edward Said are sometimes looking at 19th century British literature and saying, well, how did these writers work this magic trick of, in the most cynical version, of ensorcelling the populace not to revolt? What kind of ideological magic are they working to create this modus vivendi? And so that's why English literature is such a tempting target for the radical critic. What spell are these writers holding this populace under as they sort of patiently sit through all of this, you know, what Martin Amis called the gradualist reformism of the moderate left, essentially, or sometimes of the moderate right. But in any case, it's this moderate reformism that characterizes. But I'm not a historian and I'm not a political scientist, and I'm talking out of turn. And moreover, I've often had a vexed relationship with the Victorian period. It's not even personal. I'll tell you something I noticed. I know you like when I tell you things about academia. When I was in academia, and primarily as a graduate student, when I was first specializing as a graduate student in British literature, and there would be other graduate students who specialized in British literature and some professors who specialized in it. And I say was because I think the person who was my advisor who did British modernism retired and wasn't replaced. And so I think they're just gradually phasing British literature out as a colonial imposition in several senses of the word, colonial. So, but in any case, it used to be a bigger field, even 15, 20 years ago. And we would sort of talk, you know, my fellow graduate students and I, and the professors and I, and we would sometimes talk about this course that I'm kind of giving you the podcast version of, the British literature, the second part of the British Literature Survey from Romanticism through Modernism. And it turned, this is a a casual observation. I didn't conduct it. Nobody conducted a study, but we would often, we noticed that there were two approaches. There were three kinds of people, and those three kinds of people broke it down into two approaches. The three kinds of people were people who specialized in Romanticism, people who specialized in the Victorian era, and people who specialized in Modernism. And the way they would handle the BritLit 2 course is the people who specialized in Romanticism and Modernism would do, you know, a 15-week course, and they'd do 6 weeks on the Romantics, 6 weeks on the Modernists, and like 3 weeks on the Victorians. Because Romanticists and Modernists get along and are interested in some of the same things, and you know, it's a genius laden period. It's a very theoretically, these two periods, they're very theoretically rich. They're tied together. The Modernists are often referring back over the heads of the Victorians, whom they hate, back to the Romantics, and thus some of what the Romantics are doing seem to look forward to the Modernists. So it feels very natural to say, oh, Blake and Shelley are anticipating Joyce and Yeats, etc. And then the Victorianists, when they would teach BritLit 2, what they would do is they'd do 2 weeks on the Romantics, 2 weeks on the Modernists, and 10 weeks on the Victorians. But it's not just about preference. It was about, it drew a different kind of person with a different type of literary interest. The Victorian era, and in this I think it resembled in other British lit specializations, the medieval era, draws the cultural studies mind. It draws the mind that's interested in very granular details of historical context and how they play into the creation of literature. And they're, you know, they're not even ideologically hostile. They're sort of temperamentally hostile to the sort of grandeur of the Romantic and the Modernist way of going about things. And so I remember I did it. I was in an Oscar Wilde research seminar funded by the government in 2012. And they had very carefully selected. There are 14 participants in the seminar, and they had very carefully made sure, because Oscar Wilde is a liminal figure, he could sort of belong to the Victorians or to the Modernists, so they very carefully selected 7 Victorianists and 7 Modernists. But the director of the seminar, great guy, still around, scholar of the period out at UCLA. I won't name him because I think we're in the still in the free portion of our recording. But he was a Victorianist, and so they tended to monopolize the conversation. They were always, you know, when did dinosaur fossils begin to be dug up, and when did women's dresses cease to use crinoline, and when did William Whewell theorize his conception of science? And these are all, it's fine. I don't object. I'm not a nihilist. It's fine to talk about history. It's fine to know things, of course. But I don't know that it was always directly relevant to what Oscar Wilde was interested in. But that, I think of that as the kind of mind that's drawn to the Victorian period. And there's something, that there's something in the Victorian period that lends itself to that. The writers are larger in one way, but smaller in another, and particularly the poets. And so I played it fair when I taught this in academia, and I think I'm playing it pretty fair with you, the way I've structured this. Though I'm spending more time on the late Victorians, who interest me more. I'm spending like 4 episodes on the 40-year stretch of the mid-Victorians, and then I think I'm spending 4 episodes on like a 15-year period of like 1890 to 1905. So I am cheating a little, because I think the late Victorians, who to me are modernists, are more interesting, but I'm trying to play it fair. But I'm also going to be slightly more cultural studies-ish in my approach. My lectures will not be so resolutely often about the poet whose name is on them, but I will sort of use that poet, or in Dickens's case, though I obviously Dickens is the giant. Dickens and George Eliot are giants. I wouldn't disparage them, but even in Dickens' case, I will use them as an occasion to look more broadly at some of what's going on in the period and its culture. And I will also sneak in, because we have I have three Victorian poets I propose we discuss: Alfred Lord Tennyson today, Browning next week, and then in after we do a Dickens novel, then we'll look at Gerard Manley Hopkins. But I'm going to sneak in some other poets at times. I'll probably sneak in Mrs. Browning to Mr. Browning's lecture, and I'll probably sneak Christina Rossetti into Gerard Manley Hopkins's lecture, and I'm also going to sneak in, it is my slight suspicion, I have not researched this enough, this is a hunch I have, because I'm not a scholar of the Victorian period, and the Victorians were voluminous writers. They were not like the Romantics. They all lived to be 100 years old, and they all wrote 1,000-page books, and they wrote 1,000-page book after 1,000-page book after 1,000-page book, and nobody's going to read all that. And so I'm even more captive to the Norton Anthology than usual. But I developed a suspicion over the years that the Victorian poets, and I have to reread Browning for next week, and I love Hopkins, and I do like Tennyson, and I do like Christina Rossetti, and I don't care for Mrs. Browning, but she's important, she's interesting. They're not bad poets. They do seem to me smaller than the Romantics or the Modernists. It seems to me that figures like Blake and Shelley and figures like Yeats and Eliot sort of tower over them in certain ways. Maybe I'm being unfair. But I sometimes think it was the nonfiction prose writers that are actually the conduit, that are actually the link from the giant Romantics to the giant Modernists. And these are figures that are sometimes called Victorian sages, these kind of sage-like preachers in nonfiction prose: Thomas Carlyle, John Ruskin, Matthew Arnold, Walter Pater, even to some extent John Stuart Mill. And I'm going to be sneaking them in too. So today I'm going to talk about John Ruskin in addition to Alfred Lord Tennyson. And I'll definitely talk about Thomas Carlyle in connection to Dickens, because the Dickens novel we're reading is dedicated to Thomas Carlyle. And I'll get Arnold and Pater in there somewhere around Hopkins or Wilde. Those are some general feelings I have about the Victorian era. It's a little vexed. You want to be careful, because I did specialize in modernism, and the thing about the modernists, and we'll talk about this a little, is they hated the Victorians. They disparaged them, or they thought they did, but they were their children or they were their grandchildren, and they were constantly drawing on them as well, and wouldn't have been possible without them. So there's some kind of Oedipal thing that the modernists had against the Victorians that you pick up on if you study the modernists, and you want to kind of talk yourself out of, because it's not quite fair, not quite right. But the mid-Victorians in particular, I sometimes am less interested in. So Tennyson, though. Let's talk about Alfred Lord Tennyson. Who was Alfred Lord Tennyson? I began with a recording of his voice from 1890 on a then novel recording technology, the wax cylinder recording invented by Thomas Edison. My first image on my slideshow is a photograph. This is another first for the Invisible College. In the Romantic era, we didn't have photographs, just as we... Sorry, I hit the computer. I've got too excited about technology.